If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
In 1854, a man by the name of John McDougall was contracted to bring a team of farm horses across Okanagan Lake for several days of labor. He was to prepare his canoe and rope and swim the horses across a narrow section of water, a common and routine practice at the time. It was a calm and sunny Okanagan day. They set out into the water and had traveled several hundred meters when the horses began to frighten. Then a tug on the rope, jolting the canoe. John spun around and grabbed onto the rope, pulling back to steady himself when he realized the rear horse was being pulled under. In a panic, John reached for his knife and cut the rope, falling back in a state of abject fear as his entire team of horses was violently dragged beneath the surface. Join us tonight for episode 2 of Into the Portal, where we investigate the encounters, myth, and sightings behind the mysterious monster that lurks in Lake Okanagan, the Ogopogo.
Hello, and welcome into the portal, your gateway to the bizarre. I'm your host, Amber Ray.
And I'm Andrew McKay. Thank you so much to everybody who downloaded episode 1 on the Lost Army of Cambyses. If you haven't had a chance to check out that episode, go back into iTunes or Google Play or whatever you use, and if you're digging the show, please subscribe and leave us a review.
Those 5 stars mean a lot.
Definitely. I just have a few quick things to clear up right off the top. I wanted to mention this right away because it was kind of hilarious. I referred to our show as Portal, not Into the Portal, when I did my introduction in episode 1.
We're still debating whether or not we wanted to run with Portal or Into the Portal. So, you know, right. We've definitely decided on the latter.
Right. So we are called Into the Portal. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just wanted to clear that up. But other than that, there's not really anything to clear up. We're on everything now. We're up on Google Music, iTunes, and Podcast Addict and all that stuff.
You can check out our website. We do have our first blog entry uploaded, as well as our show notes for episode 1.
Yeah, so if you're interested in some of the, not just the show notes, but the resources we looked into for that first episode.
Links for everything.
They're all up there, so
there's
you can go check it out.
There's additional reading as well, if you want to check out some, like, you know, more denser material.
Definitely. All right, that's enough of that. Let's get into this, because I've been looking forward to this all week. It's been a big build-up. And it's just a sweet story, so let's get
really
right into it.
It's a hometown legend for us, so, you know, we've grown up with this. It's been around for our entire lives, so.
Yeah, it's weird, right? Like, we you know, we've heard the story about the Ogopogo, and we'll get into the actual term for that creature, and Ogopogo came along a lot later. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a European add-on for sure.
Yeah, but the white man.
But, yeah, it's weird growing up in the area and always hearing about it, but never really looking into the actual facts behind it, the sightings, the myth, the encounters. So this has been really fun for us.
Definitely.
So let's get right into it then. Let's start with, we're going to go over a little bit. We want to give a little bit of context here for the legend and things like that. So we'll go into, let's talk a little bit about the background of the area, I guess.
Yeah.
The Okanagan peoples. So some of these words are really hard to pronounce for us. We're going to try our best. That was an issue in the first episode too.
Them.
But we apologize for that. We will try our best. But the Okanagan peoples, the Silks peoples, is I believe the correct pronunciation of that. They have a very rich history in the region. So they've been around, the Okanagan peoples, it's estimated that at the height of the Okanagan culture in the area, it was about 3,000 years ago. Around 12,000 people was the estimated population. And that territory ranged through down into what is now Washington, across the border, and basically along the Columbia River and its tributaries and other lakes and things like that in the area that runs all the way up through into BC, where we are in Kelowna and Vernon, Penticton, all those other cities on Lake Okanagan.
So, but the like we said before, the Ogopogo, that's not the name. It's actually pronounced Nahatik.
Nahatik. I have seen another spelling that almost makes it seem as if it's pronounced Nahataka.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Naitatka. So I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce that. Right.
But that's the indigenous word for it, and it's basically translates as lake demon.
It does.
And it's a sacred. It was a a sacred creature. Mm-hmm. Like over the
they
years,
they revered it. They respected it. And they, at every point, when they cross near Squally Point, right. That is, they would give a live offering to this lake demon.
And we're going to get into where Squally Point is and how the, mm-hmm. that fits into the legend. And it's sort of been known as the potential home of the Ogopogo. But we'll get into that in yes. a little bit. So first off, do you want to get into some of the details on the lake? Or actually, let's go through the origin story, because that's fascinating.
The origin story of the legend. I think that's right. important to cover here. So off the bat, we just want to disclose that we... we're in contact with a local museum that specializes in this type of history, the Okanagan peoples. We haven't yet had a chance to visit their museum. We are definitely going to be visiting next week, though. Mm-hmm. There'll be some additional content, some stuff to look into.
We couldn't wait. We were too excited to do this episode, yes. so we just kind of bit the
bullet. Scheduling purposes, we're getting this going tonight.
Definitely.
But anyways, so just look forward to some more content in mm-hmm. the next week or so. But the source I managed to find, it was from a paranormal researcher organization called Exploring the Unexplained.
Okay.
I have a quote from them here, specific to the Ogopogo. All right, and I'll read it out to you. So, quote, "The legend of the Ogopogo starts with a demon-possessed native man named Kaloniwan, who murdered a well-known and respected elder named Old Kanikan, with a war club. As punishment for his crime, the creator changed Kaloniwan into a lake serpent, a creature who would forever be imprisoned at the scene of his crime to suffer eternal remorse. He was left in the custody of a beautiful lake goddess. Kaloniwan was from that day known as Nahatik, the remorseful one who must live in the lake in the company of other animals. It is said that the only animal who could tolerate his company was the rattlesnake. To honor the memory of Old Kanikan, the people named the lake Okanagan."
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. That's
a little quote there.
And we don't 100. We still have to look into the background of that. But I've yes. definitely come across some things that would lend to that being true mm-hmm. as an origin story. We watched a few documentaries too where they talk about the origin. They don't go into too much detail, but no. And we're going to get into some of those documentaries in a little
there
bit.
There was a really good quote though.
Yeah, from, go for that one right now.
Yeah. I definitely wanted to include that just off the bat here. This was from Ursula Searchies, Kelowna Museum director, and this is a part of the In Search of documentary that is hosted by Leonard Nimoy.
Spock. Really cool.
We were pretty stoked when we saw that, yeah. And we've been basically chain watching In Search of since.
Pretty much.
And we would highly recommend it.
Yeah. It'll be up on our YouTube channel.
We're going to have links up there. So you can check out that playlist, and we're going to have more up in the future, because it's a phenomenal resource.
It's pretty fun.
It's so retro, too.
It's super just, retro. Super
the
retro.
Quality of the film is just...
But anyway, get to that quote, because it's really cool.
Yeah, sorry, we're getting off topic already. All right, so Ursula Searchies, Kelowna Museum director, quote, "We have learned Indian legends have a very substantial amount of fact and truth to them."
Right.
End quote.
And this was back in the 60s.
It was, yes, when she made this statement. And I think it just lends a lot of legitimacy to the Okanagan people's perspective Definitely. On their surroundings. And yeah, it just, I don't know.
I mean, all these things are being passed down it's profound. I think it's exactly. profound. It's, mm-hmm. These stories and legends and things are passed down through oral tradition. And of course, they'll inevitably pick up different sort of things along the way. But this mm-hmm. is a story for the Okanagan peoples that's really important to them.
It is.
And it's almost like the Ogopogo is, it's representative of the lake and sort of the relationship with water. And we'll mm-hmm. get back into that
and
a little bit,
too. The importance of it. And just,
but, that's a great quote to kind of leave things
like
off here.
I feel like, in a sense, you could almost interpret it as a metaphor for respect for nature and the changeability of the lake itself, right? Because
right.
if I read on a little further into this original quote I had, I didn't want to read the whole thing because it's kind of long.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah, what it says here is the fee for a safe passage was a live sacrifice. Whenever the natives who lived around the lake would venture out in the water, they would sacrifice a small animal to appease the monster. Mm. They would drop into the lake. It would drown. This ensured a protected journey. It was told that the shore of Rattlesnake Island was littered with the gory remnants of the travelers who did not make a sacrifice. So Nahatik would use his mighty tail to whip up the lake's water into a fierce storm that would drown its victims. The white settlers also followed the native warnings, yet the white man also lapsed at times and had to be reminded of the monster's wrath.
Interesting.
Which, you know, our intro did definitely demonstrate an example of that, I feel.
Very much
in
so.
In a very dramatic way. Indeed. But I feel like that, you know, like, it's not as if this this monster is coming up and snatching people from their boats and dragging them into the, well, in the case of the...
In that particular story.
Exactly. But I feel like it's more, it's a little more allegorical. It's a little looser, right? Like, and we've experienced it, right, growing up in the Okanagan, the changeability of the water itself and the wind patterns.
It can get pretty intense out there. I mean, we're in a, the Okanagan Lake is in a valley, and it's a fairly narrow valley. It gets pretty intense wind storms.
It does.
And that can definitely whip things up on the water, and it's a dangerous place to be. So I definitely think a lot of that can be allegorical for sure. From other, you know, stories and things
to a
passed
certain
down
extent.
To a certain extent
doesn't
but
actually
like
account
the
for the sightings
says,
but
exactly it doesn't account for a lot of the things that we are definitely going to cover in this episode, so let's keep going
definitely
let's... Yeah, I guess that was another thing from the first episode. We forgot to cover the physics of sandstorms, which I believe I mentioned at the beginning.
Oh yes.
So maybe we'll post something. I think we have something
we did
posted
have a, source, for that,
a
yeah.
source posted about that. Anyway, we're already getting off track.
Okay,
so let's get into a little bit about the lake itself.
Well, yeah, just to give another, yeah,
just
more
to give
context.
Some context, because this Okanagan Lake is, it's pretty unique. It's one of the oldest and deepest lakes in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a lot of lakes in Canada, so that's,
it is a glacially formed lake,
which is the reason
carved
why.
Out by repeated glaciations.
Exactly. So it's
also prone to volcanic activity.
There's quite a few
extinct now,
extinct
but,
volcanoes,
you know,
in the
back
area
in the day.
Back in the day. But yeah, one of the oldest and deepest in Canada. It's around 90 kilometers long.
I've heard estimates up to 112
yeah
kilometers
varying
long.
Lengths
does vary
so but
about
I mean
45 kilometers wide.
There's, you know, there's three major cities that are of British Columbia that are along this lake. We've got Penticton and then Kelowna in the middle and then Vernon up at the north end. Penticton and Vernon are a little smaller, but I mean still decent size. I mean it's a big lake.
Yeah.
It's a big lake, you know, 4 to 5 kilometers wide depending on the location, and at least 800 feet deep. There are people that dispute how deep this is.
It's never actually been mapped.
It hasn't been fully mapped. There's been some seismic mapping that we actually, we spoke to a geologist, and we'll have her as a guest later in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But she said that it hasn't been necessarily fully mapped. There's just been some sort of basic seismic mapping. But up to 1,000 feet, some people say. And then beneath that, so you got 1,000 feet from the surface to the sediment on the bottom of the deepest parts of the lake. Then you've got 750 meters of sediment before you hit bedrock. So
in
this
some
is,
places.
In some places. This is not everywhere in the lake.
No.
But this is in some of these deeper sections of the water. And that's just kind of crazy. I just wanted to throw that out there. So just for perspective on that, the tallest building in the world, I think, as of 2016, is the Burj Khalifa in Dubai. So it's 600 meters or 2,000 feet. So add another 450 feet of sediment plus 1,000 feet potential of water, and then you're at the surface of Okanagan Lake. So over 3,200 feet. So that's crazy. And the sediment is organic material, inorganic material.
And it is from the glacial periods.
Right.
Right. You get a lot of that sort of loose material.
Totally.
And yeah.
And there's some interesting theories on the sediment and things
definitely,
like that.
Definitely,
that
we'll, yeah. It's a part of the theory section of this episode.
Which is what the bulk of this episode is, really, because it's a lake monster that we're searching for, that people have been looking for a long time, and
been a lot of
there's
attempts.
Some bizarre stories about
bring
it, and then there's
that
ones
too,
that are
yeah.
a lot more credible, and we've handpicked the ones that we think are the most profound, and that kind
as
of
as far as sightings.
As far as sightings, and then
there's a few expeditions we'll mention later on as well.
Indeed. Well, what are we getting into here, then?
Well, I think we should start at the start.
Start at the start.
Start at the start.
That's a good place to start.
It is. All right. So that would be in the 1800s then. And this is one of the earliest pioneer accounts by a woman named Susan Allison. So this Susan Allison, she was a BC pioneer and she was an author. And she reportedly saw the beast near her home, which is now the property of Quail's Gate Winery in West Kelowna.
Yeah.
Very fascinating. She was actually the first white person in the Okanagan, I believe.
She was the first, like, permanent settler on the west side. Yeah, she was the first non-Indigenous, her and her husband, and then they started a family here. Mm-hmm. Like, her full name was Susan Louisa Moore Allison. So she was originally from England, relocated to Hope, BC, and then eventually made her way out to the Okanagan. But she actually established the very first ever school in Hope with her mother. And she went on to write a couple of books, and she had her memoirs that were later published in the 70s, Pioneer Gentlewoman, and that was
We'll be posting a link to that.
To that. It's actually hilarious. We both, Amber and I, covered that book in, I can't even remember what it was.
Cultural studies class,
and it was
one of our favorite profs, one of Jen our favorite MacArthur. It was
really dry, the book itself, and it's so funny coming back to it years later trying to dig out this little piece of evidence that lends to the idea that the Ogopogo might actually exist. It's kind of funny, full circle for us and Susan.
So, her full account, well, I don't actually have her quote, but essentially, yeah, she was at her home called Sunnyside Ranch, and she described seeing a snake-like creature closely mirroring the native legend about Nahaltik.
Right.
So, yes.
And the thing about her is that she, I mean, it's, yeah, and that first account is not exactly, it doesn't jump out at you. Like, some crazy story about seeing someone have horses pull beneath the surface, like John McDougall's story. But what's profound to me about Susan Allison's account is that after reading that book, you know, it sort of reminds me a little bit of some of the things in the Herodotus in episode one, where she writes really she's very dry about most things, right?
Yeah.
So it and including the account of Ogopogo, so it's just like there's no embellishment.
No, not a lot of colorful language.
There's no embellishment. There's no jazzing it up. So it seems strange, like, why would you say that if you didn't actually see what you thought you saw? And of course, she may have been mistaken, but she was privy to the legend from the people she met and lived amongst in the Okanagan. And I think she's a credible witness.
I think she is too.
So that's a kind of a cool first account for sure.
Definitely.
So that was 1873, right?
Yeah.
1873.
That's the date I have
here. And then we're moving on to, I mean, here's the thing with this story. This is, we'll come back to some other points, but like, it's the most photographed lake monster in the world, supposedly.
Yeah.
It's one of the...
Even though a lot of them just look like waves.
A lot of them look just like... A lot of them are just waves. I'm going to say that right now, obviously.
No way to tell.
But there's a million... Every year, there's hundreds of sightings. Hundreds of sightings every single year. Not all of them are reported, obviously. Some of them just get floated out there as stories. But we've handpicked just a few. Because if we were going to go through all of the... Even the compelling ones, this would be like a 15-part episode.
It would be.
So we're trying to make it a one-part episode.
I would say that the next one would be just a quick mention. I believe it was 1914, 1915 perhaps. I don't have the date in front of me right now.
It was 1914. I remember you brought this up.
1914. Okay, awesome.
Yeah,
and that was the... the Okanagan peoples and I believe the Kootenai peoples. It was a joint... group expedition, but they were traveling alongside the lake shore near Beachland, and they happened upon a carcass that was about, it was a dark grayish blue, and it was about 5 to 6 feet long with small flippers, and they didn't know what to make of it.
This is bizarre.
It almost, like, the description kind of like brings to mind a dolphin to me.
Yeah, or like a manatee, quite small, or something. Or like...
But they kind of interpret it as a baby Ogopogo. Because the creature we're talking about has been reported to I think it's between 20 to 50 meters. Or sorry, feet.
Yeah, 50. Up to 60, up to 60 feet in the folded film.
Up to 60?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe.
Okay.
Which is massive, obviously.
So that's obviously a lot bigger than what they found. Yeah. But at the same time, you think they'd know if they were looking at a big old salmon or a tuna or something, or,
obviously,
you know?
Yeah, which obviously wouldn't be here, a tuna, but like something like that. Like something,
you have to wonder. I mean, that was before the damming of the lake.
Right.
So, you know.
Could have been some sort of tributary that was a large enough, you know, waterway that something strange from somewhere else got in. The Okanagan Lake used to be connected to the Columbia, I'm fairly certain, up in the Arrow Lakes area before a dam was put in the 50s. And that's a point that was mentioned in one of the later documentaries that we reference in this episode. But yeah, that's a weird find.
It is.
Because...
And from the, like, Okanagan natives, like, you know, they would probably have the most experience. Well, obviously they
Of course.
Been here the longest and, you know, they live...
Like, avid hunters and know the area and all that stuff.
Connected to the land.
I mean, of course, yeah, I mean, 1914, it seems odd that somebody would... That it could have been an animal transported from somewhere else or just some weird...
Someone's coincidence pet that got
loose. Or something. Yeah. Your sea monkey that grew to be 7 feet long and died on the beach. No, that's weird.
Sea monkey.
But the flippers thing doesn't match up with basically most of the other sightings and things like
most
that.
Most of the sightings are when it's like partially submerged, though.
Very
so
true.
The fins could be below water.
Very true.
Yeah.
Potentially.
So, moving on. Next sighting.
Yeah, so a few years later, 1928. The Mission Beach sighting. Now, this is one of the better known ones.
It is. It involved 30 plus cars.
It basically...
Tons of witnesses.
It had the most witnesses out of any of the sightings that we researched, that we looked at. So, yeah, 30 plus cars. And I'm thinking 30 plus cars, that's got to be presumably...
At least two people per car.
And you'd think. I mean,
probably more.
I'm
if they're at the beach, everyone's piling in the car going
you'd
down.
You'd think. I mean,
there's probably people in the trunk. You know? It's like sneaking into the drive-in.
Yeah, there's probably not too many lonely people going to the beach by themselves that day, I would imagine. So, like, conservatively, I'm thinking 45, 50 people saw this. Saw
and it was a prolonged sighting, too. It wasn't just a brief little, what was that? And then
yeah, that's
gone.
Right. How long did this?
It was a few minutes.
Like,
that was all I heard.
Like five, six
I couldn't actually
or
confirm the,
Which doesn't sound like a lot of time, but in reality,
but
that's a
really
long
is,
time.
Yeah.
That's a really long time. And basically, what people saw was there wasn't an exact reference as to how many feet out from the beach it was that I could find. But
it was,
by
a dock, wasn't it?
They had a frame. Yeah, they had a reference point at least. Like they could. It was close enough that they were like, what the heck are we looking at?
They didn't need binoculars.
No, they didn't need binoculars. And they basically saw what a lot of other people would end up seeing throughout the years, which was, I believe, three humps. So it surfaced. I don't think there was a head seen, but what was seen was the body traveling.
It's pretty vague.
And, it just looked really weird. Weird enough for that many people to watch
That's
and then have people stop because people were watching.
Yeah.
So... That's kind of crazy.
I think that's kind
of
crazy, too.
I mean, what do you make of that account?
Like, were they all drunk?
I mean, obviously, you're chilling at the beach, you might be having a few pops, but...
Like, how hot was it that day? Are we seeing mirages in the water? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, it couldn't have been.
I don't know.
Well, we hang out at the beach and
what if it's a bunch of salmon, though? What if they're splashing all around and getting crazy and...
Splashing all around and getting crazy.
I don't know.
Definitely not. I mean, people aren't going to mistake that.
It's 1928. We don't have any footage.
No, unfortunately, we don't have footage. But I'm thinking people... Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough one when you have a mass sighting. It's like, on the
one
hand...
Was it one person making a mountain of a molehill and they were just directing the
and then it's
entire
sort of,
crowd?
And then it kind of gets all, you know, people get into sort of the... Yeah, it's a crowd atmosphere and it's like, what the heck? And it's just this sort of...
What is that? Hey, mob mentality.
And it's just actually
sense?
A log out in the water or something, right? Like
some couple beavers.
And that's totally a possibility.
Around.
But that side
we don't
want to
discredit them. But
no,
we
can't.
Do want to mention
mean,
every possibility at the same
definitely.
Time.
Definitely, it's tough to discredit this one because you just
it's tough to credit it and
edit.
It's tough to discredit
exactly.
it. It's kind of just a.
It's not enough.
It
evidence.
Is what it is. None
not
of those people
evidence.
Are alive anymore, probably.
You know, it's a funny note, though. In 2 years before this, actually, because there's been sightings, like, forever there's been sightings. And I don't know if this was just completely a joke or if some people were serious about this, but in 1926, this is an art, just a snippet from the Daily Colonist.
Mm-hmm.
1926, the city of Kelowna announces a new ferry that would be monster-proof. So...
Do you actually have that clipping?
I have a link. Yeah,
it's
I have
from
a link.
The comments, right?
It's totally free. Yeah, it's totally public access. So we'll have a link for that. And there's a bunch of really awesome newspaper snippets on the
Ogopogo.
Oh my god,
it's hilarious.
It's really funny. Some of them
it's
are
just
more serious.
A gossip column. Oh,
some
well,
of, well
just
some
the
of them
newspaper
are more serious.
In general.
And yeah.
I mean.
Well, yeah, back in the day, yeah. It's like.
And then it's weird because we were searching through these obviously because we want some primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
But we did find Ogopogo like sightings in other lakes too.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is...
And other creatures, too, that are also, like, sightings in freshwater, like Champ and Lake
so,
Champlain.
So
and...
maybe that kind of lends to the idea that there are these sort of cryptid things that can exist sort of below human conscious level.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe are living in these streams. And, like, you know, like, that was... Maybe that fed into Okanagan Lake, and now Augie's down here.
Well, you never know. I don't know. And that's the idea of tunnels and deep caves in the lake is something that is definitely part of that theory, and we will get to that in just a sec, because that's my favorite part of the story.
So that was 1928 at Mission Beach. There's obviously been a lot of sightings in between this and the next one we'll mention, but we think that this is definitely a pivotal part of the Ogopogo mystery.
We skipped 40 years here because there just wasn't enough there wasn't really enough within that 40 years that was that compelling in terms of evidence.
It was just that we could more find anecdotal stories, right? And a lot of those came from the In Search Of that we watched about Ogopogo, and they were, that is a very illuminating piece on just Kelowna culture back in the 60s and 70s, right? I don't know. It was just a different time, hey?
Totally. With people like gathering together to tell their stories, and it was much more of like a...
The radio station put out a call for people to gather and tell their stories, and everyone came out, and what is out now... apparently I can't talk. What is now outside of Earl's, downtown Kelowna.
Yeah, downtown.
Yeah. We could actually recognize, we could see the back, and we're like, what?
Yeah, you could see the dock. You could see the old ferry.
It was like
the
dinkiest little dock ever.
It was hilarious. It's wild to think that so much has changed since just then.
It is crazy.
So anyway, we skip 40 years though.
Sorry, yeah. Getting on to the Folden film.
The Folden film, this one's important.
It really is.
This was the basis of the argument for an author named Arlene Gall, who I can't remember where she was from exactly, but she had three books.
She came from a different part of the province, but she moved here with her, I think she was from even just Armstrong or something, just further up north.
Anyway, and she wrote some great books on Ogopogo, and those are ones that we'll eventually have up in our bookstore on our website.
I think the last one was in 2001.
So really recent, and
she's still alive.
She's still around. She's in her 80s now.
Yeah.
But the Folden film was one of the focal points for her research, and it's because it was taken in 1968 by a man named Art Folden,
he and his wife were traveling through Peachland,
right? Mm-hmm. And he saw something strange as they were driving. I think they were sort of, maybe the story goes that they were coming up to the shoulder, and they were going to maybe pull off and take a little break, and he caught something just before that, and then they really decided to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of distance.
Yeah.
Like, it's quite far away.
Almost looks like the top of Naramata, hey, when you go up that windy road, like, and then you're looking way down.
It's high.
It must have been an old road, because it's not the highway we know today.
Oh, no, it's definitely an older road for sure. Mm-hmm. But he basically caught footage of, there was a frame of reference in terms of the distance. So, like, you can see the tree line on the shores on the shore and stuff like that. So they ended up doing some analysis later on. But basically, you got to go and check out this video. We will also put that on our YouTube channel as well, because it's really cool. And basically, it was what they estimated to be a 60 foot long, 3 foot wide. This is later estimations from footage analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Creature
conducted in the 2000s.
Surfacing and submerging, traveling at a good clip. I can't remember the exact estimate.
Well, it was
speed,
creating a wake.
And when you watch this video, it was later analyzed and determined that there was no tampering with the footage. That there's clearly a solid object, animate object that's moving quickly,
a large animal,
and you can clearly tell when it surfaces, and then there's the front end, and then there was a back hump, and then it submerges for a little while, and then it would resurface again, but not in a straight line, kind of a little bit off to the side, and it was clearly something
very serpentine,
just clearly something moving very suspiciously.
So that for her was pivotal, and she actually ended up buying the Folden film off of the original owner. And I believe she still has it in her possession today. And that was how the Monster Quest was able to do their analysis and verify.
You can find clips of it, I think, now. Like,
oh,
it's
been
pirated,
can.
Obviously.
It's not like, well, I mean, it was featured in the documentary, too.
True. Yeah, I mean, it's just out there. But it's a short clip, but it is, it's
fascinating, really.
It kind of makes you never want to swim in the middle of the lake again. For me, like whether it's actually, you know, regardless of what it might be, it's freaky. Freaks me out.
Especially according to this next account, where the creature was reportedly, this is a quote, 2 blocks away from shore.
Yeah, 2 blocks.
So this comes from Ed Fletcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This guy's a trip. I like him a lot.
He is, yeah. And his first sighting occurred in the 1970s at some point. He's not specific. But he did say that they've seen Augie over 40 times.
They named it, eh? They called it Augie.
That's more my nickname. I don't think they call it Augie. I just like to say Augie. It's cute. That's
funny.
But yeah, anyways, no, yeah, their first sighting was pretty startling for them, obviously. It was him and his daughter. They were in their little speedboat. And the speedboat is integral to the story, too. So they spotted this creature 2 blocks from shore, as I said, and it was described by them as having, quote, just one hump, 3 feet high, and dark colored. So the two of them chased the creature for about 1.5 hours. And yeah, apparently he's come up with his own theory, though, and that was the boat vibrations theory.
Mm-hmm.
He believes now that he was actually attracting the monster, which is why he saw him over 40 times or so, he claims.
Yeah.
And that this electrolysis effect, that is actually used in fishing, apparently. I'm not a fisher, but it's a thing. But yeah, I was apparently just attracted to that, so he claims. So that was actually utilized in further investigations as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I guess it was like a jet engine on this particular boat,
and
that's
what gave off that frequency. It was the vibration frequency, yeah.
That
the
it would motor. Attract, with be within the range to attract marine life. That's wild. That's really crazy, cool. Eh? Like, well, I mean, it's not, I mean, it's
like, totally... was he attracting anything else, though? That's my question.
I mean, you think if he dropped a fishing line, he might catch something, if that's
like, what
sort
were they
of...
doing out there? Just boating around? Probably, I guess.
He obviously became obsessed with the story, because he would kind of attempt to... find Ogopogo.
He did. Yeah, he went to
great
marine
lengths.
Researchers. He went to an aquarium.
He went down further... to Southern California for to like an advanced marine research center
to see if they could identify the animal.
He was describing what he saw, and basically what he saw was, he described it as, I mean, definitely no fins, flippers,
no scales.
Like that.
It was very smooth, dark.
Smooth like a shark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, yeah, no,
or an eel,
or an eel or a whale,
and
he said as well.
What's interesting about the footage that he took is that it appears as though there's sort of like a ripple, like maybe of like not fins, but you know, like a center strip going down its back kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you notice that when
yeah,
you actually
yeah, yeah,
zoomed
right.
in on
that's
the film?
Right, yeah.
It was almost eel like, you know how eels have that little sort of like flappy thing on top.
It did seem to be like there was some sort of a pronounced shape,
a ridging
on the top.
Perhaps it could have been the waves, or it could have been the water. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing that we
and we'll get back to that theory too.
Yeah, because it ties there's a few things that theories based on wave dynamics and water that sort of try to debunk Ed Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we thought was really interesting, so we'll come back to that in just
yeah.
a sec.
So
but his photos were, I mean, are you want ready to move on to Bill?
Oh, well, if you... Yeah, no, go for
I
it.
Mean,
if you got some more Ed Fletch.
Yeah, I mean, like, for him...
I'm into the Fletch.
Yeah, he was just sort of an oddball to me, like, but he sounded so sincere.
He's a character.
He, you know, he
apparently
was...
he's from Prince George.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And he just was, like, vacationing down in the Okanagan.
He might have been living...
I mean, like...
I don't know, he might have been a summer resident. Obviously,
okay.
He liked to boat, so... I don't think he'd do much boating in Prince George. It's... comparable to the Okanagan.
Yeah, I'd say. No offense to people that live in Prince George.
Oh, not at all. Just, yeah. I've actually never been there.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, his account, I also think is genuine, like, from watching the footage of him talking
mm-hmm.
about it. And the fact that they got within as close as they did, like, the photos...
He was kind of obsessed.
He was obsessed, but not to the point where it was, like, gonna, I think, cloud his...
Not for publicity.
No, he wasn't in it for that.
I don't think it was for that.
No.
I did get that impression.
But his photos are really, really... I mean, they're
yeah.
definitely in the... they're up there with the Folden film in terms of the
most... So he's copyrighted those, or what's going on
there? I mean, I don't even think Ed Fletcher's... I mean, he may not even still be around.
Okay, wait, so this is the 70s, and it's now 2018.
Well, who knows how old this guy
was. We're on the brink of it being public domain anyway, right?
Yeah.
It's only 50 years, and it's just...
No, it's out there. You Google it, Ed Fletcher.
You can definitely find it.
Ogopogo photos. It's on Google.
We
found
it.
And there, you know, if you have a chance to...
find it, you can definitely find it.
Yeah, and if you've got a chance to blow it up and look at it, it's really neat. But yeah, if you watch
the... And it is featured in some of the documentaries that we have listed on our YouTube, so...
Mm-hmm.
You can just go ahead and check those out, and you'll find it all.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to the next sighting.
We've got a couple more to cover. This guy in particular, Bill Stachewyck, I wanted to mention. Hope I'm saying his last name right. Sorry, Bill, if I'm not. He's a local Legend Hunters. So it's an organization called Legend Hunters, and they have a website called ogopogoquest.com. And apparently his first sighting happened in 1978 when he was crossing the bridge from the west side to Kelowna. So apparently he caught a movement in the lake and he stopped his car in the middle of the bridge. So all the traffic behind him also stopped. I'm not sure if they did that because they had to stop or because they wanted to. I didn't make that distinction. Just I don't know.
In front of everybody.
But apparently he was soon joined at the rail by about 20 other people. So yeah. Wow. What they saw was a head with three black humps protruding about 60 meters away. So they watched it swim for about nearly a minute. And then after that, it disappeared beneath the water surface, leaving a substantial lake.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's another, obviously, mass sighting. And that
yeah, so that's 20-plus people. And he became an avid believer after that. Yeah. He founded this website. He actually has had two expeditions into the lake, which we will cover in a bit. We're just going chronologically here.
That encounter, you know, matches up with Ed Fletcher, too, in terms of the skin. The dark, it does. Dark, smooth.
The dark, smooth, yeah.
So there's some.
He saw three black humps. Ed Fletch only saw one, but right. You know,
but who knows? I mean, just you just saw a part of it.
Right? Okay, so are these actual like U shaped humps with the whole thing coming out, or is it just like a little bit of a hump coming out?
Well, I mean, if what they saw
like
was
the statues are obviously really like that we
well,
see.
Well, it's a cartoon,
exactly,
I mean, it's
right?
Done to
so
be
that's
pronounced.
Exaggerated,
of course.
But
I think if it was anything like the photos from the Ed Fletcher photos, it's not. As pronounced like that
because like it the movement be... is it up and down in the water or is it side to side, right? Like if it's side to side, I'm picturing an eel more so than like a plesiosaur.
Yeah,
or
the way it moves definitely would lead to whether or not would determine like whether or not it is exposed
yeah.
to the like above the surface,
or can I just do both? It's like ambidextrousness for marine life. I don't know.
Yeah, we're not marine biologists, just in case anybody out there didn't know already. Yeah, I mean, definitely some odd similarities, though, with that account.
Hocus Pocus Quest. Check it out. He's got
it's
t-shirts
a great
for
website.
Sale. They look like a lovely family.
Yeah. The t-shirts are pretty funny. But yeah. No, he did some great research. And yeah, it's a good resource for looking into this, for sure.
Yeah. So that's Ed. And so that concludes the 1970s. We're going to jump into the 2000s now.
Yeah, we're going to jump into the 2000s. And this account...
I feel like this one is just cool. Because even though it is... a single person that witnessed it, like this is like freaky to me because he saw it not once but twice, and he saw more than one creature. So,
more than one, and that's something that will
so that lends to the idea that maybe there's a population.
That's something that we ran into a lot,
and we did see that in some of the footage. Dan Barasada, I think his last name was, or Basarada, or I don't know, I'm probably getting that wrong, but he posted two sightings. Remember, there was one in it was like August 14th, 2001, and the next year was like 2002, the exact same day. And I was confused about initially. I was like, is this a typo? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But what he actually has footage of, it almost looks like three creatures, or at least two.
Yeah.
So anyways, there's that idea.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Daryl Ellis, this guy, he is a marathon swimmer. His sighting was reported in 2000. So while he was competing, actually, I'm not sure if he was in
the
actual
training,
marathon.
He was training, I think. He was training,
okay.
Yeah.
So he reported being
accompanied.
It wasn't
the Iron Man or anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't his birthday, was it? Was he the guy that swam the lake for his birthday?
I think that was a different guy.
Was it? Okay.
Anyway, but we know he was a marathon swimmer for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so it's Daryl. Daryl Ellis. He reported being accompanied for a short distance during his swim by two large creatures as he passed Rattlesnake Island, also known as Squally Point. So he described them as being 6 to 9 meters. So that's about 20 to 30 feet. And the second one was a bit smaller than that. So they followed him for quite a while and then disappeared. So they're peaceful, at least. And then while he was swimming near the Okanagan Lake floating bridge, when we still had the floating bridge.
Yeah, way back in the day.
A creature with a large eye the size of a grapefruit came within 9 meters to get a close look at him.
Oh my god.
That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
And I actually saw, this was from the Legend Hunters website, which is Bill Stachewyk's website, and he had an artist rendition of what Daryl Ellis saw, and it's a beautiful portrait. I thought it was more peaceful and demure as opposed to scary. Like, you know, it wasn't frightening at
it's
all.
It's not, but... like, outright scary, but it's also
a lot
a
of people
bit...
do refer to the Okpogo as the friendly monster, right?
It's definitely
he definitely
noted.
Isn't known for dragging people down.
No,
unless
it's
you're,
been, it's
you
been,
know,
yeah,
John McDougal.
Yeah, if
but
you
he
believe
managed
that
to
story,
escape, too.
If you believe that story to be true.
I feel
true,
like he just, well, anyways.
You never know. But it's definitely been obviously blown up into just a tourist trap, and that takes away from the actual legend and the possibility of that legend being based off of an actual
some sort of
an actual creature
of some sort or something that is unknown.
But that's where we come in. We're trying to kind of like bridge somewhere in between.
We're asking questions.
We want to ask questions and just sort of perpetuate the conversation, but still have some fun. And I mean, like we said last time, we're fox maulers, so we want to believe.
We do.
I want the Ogopogo to be real.
I just want to believe, and swimming. I never want to swim in that lake ever again. I'm already terrified of
you
it.
You don't
anyway.
Even like swimming anyway.
Honestly, when I was young, I had terrible experiences with water, and I've just been scarred for life.
So the Ogopogo doesn't help.
People don't want me to swim in water. They're mean. They leave me in the middle of lakes with nothing but myself, and I look down, and there's just black water, and I don't
and
even
then
know
you
how.
See a serpent.
It's like literally like you're hovering over a massive abyss.
Nobody
and you
likes
don't
that.
Know
Nobody
what's
likes
underneath,
that.
And that is crazy.
That's terrifying to me too.
It's my worst nightmare.
Totally.
Anyways, I'm getting a heart attack thinking about it. So
I mean, yeah, that account is scary though, Daryl.
Isn't
Ellis.
It?
It's like.
He said
in that account too, like they seemed peaceful. It's just observing him, but he wrote, like he said, I booked it. Like he was scared, and he turned up the speed. Like he went into another gear like to get going, because he was like, I'm not gonna just be swimming leisurely with these strange black creatures following me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah. So what are we moving on to now? I mean, I think we've got
the main stories we wanted to cover.
Those were the most profound ones that we came across.
Definitely, if you have your own, though, share them with us. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah, reach out and let us know.
Maybe you can get featured in an upcoming minisode or something else.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to get into... We watched a couple of docs on the Ogopogo, and they were totally different. It's two totally different styles, different eras for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to get into a little bit of the details on that. And
as well as the expedition launched by the Legend Hunters, because that's kind of important.
Okay, well, what would you want to get into that? Let's do that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's...
So this is actually kind of cool. It's a good segue from the last story, because this expedition took place in 2000 as well. So basically, this was put on by Bill Stachewyck and his team at the local Legend Hunters. And essentially, they used sonar technology, and they searched the area around Squally Point. So it was actually kind of cool. They did discover on the 18th day something very big and rapidly approaching that they picked up on their sonar. It had about a 35-second sweep time, so you get the delay, right? So they see this big object is moving towards them.
Yeah.
And then they see it. It was apparently estimated to be 15 meters long, and it was at the time that they picked it up on the radar, it was 48 meters in front of the boat, at a depth of about 7.5 meters. So anyways, they had to wait this 35 seconds for the sweep. Could you imagine? You're on the boat, there's this large thing coming towards you, you're like is this it? I'm not sure.
In
that time, the creature like object moved 5 degrees to the port, and then half a minute later it dropped below the... So that was encouraging for them.
That's real evidence of something.
Actually like measurable. Obviously, you don't know what that was, but if it's that big, 15 meters long, like nothing in the lake that we know of is 15 meters long. So, and it's not a freaking log, man. Logs don't move that fast.
An underwater log just propelling
itself. Is there
itself
like a jet stream under
jet
the water
logs.
That's just...
Yeah,
anyways,
no.
I don't think so. So that was encouraging for them. They did launch another expedition the following summer with inconclusive results. They searched Squally Point as well as the area 3 kilometers north of Kelowna and Seclusion Bay. But again, nothing.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that was that. Then we had the docks, right? So there was the two we have already mentioned, the In Search Of a couple times. Did you have any other things you wanted to add to that? Or
no, not really. That was sort of it for that.
Yeah.
It was...
This is so fast. I love it. I'm going to go back and watch it again right now.
Now we can watch it again later.
Yep.
So
but
that
the
was...
other one then, the second doc, Monster Quest.
Yeah.
So that was from 2009.
And Monster Quest is a fun series. It's fun.
It's fun. It's kind of sensationalist.
It's definitely sensationalist. They don't really... There's not a lot of substance.
There's definitely some questionability of their tactics. And
I mean, they do the classic where it's like they send their diver down and... They make it sound as if he's hundreds of feet down, but he's really only like 30 feet down, and then...
Then they lose the
they
connection.
They lose connection, and then they cut
no
to commercial.
No communications,
And then when you come back from commercial,
I feel
I'm good.
You know, shows like that are plagued by television formats to a certain extent, right? Because you need the hook. You need that because you know you're going to have commercial
breaks. Hook these days isn't just the idea that you might find a sea monster. People need some certain death or something. People need all these things to entertain them.
Yeah.
I guess those people won't be listening to our podcast probably.
Yeah, I know.
And that's okay, I guess.
That's fine with me. But anyways, Monster Quest, yeah, they did definitely note that the Okanagan Lake is one of the largest, oldest, and deepest glacial lakes in North America,
mm-hmm.
and that this monster in particular has been the most sighted and documented lake beast in the world. And their expedition used thermal imaging techniques and electrolysis, the same technology that Ed Fletch claimed attracted the beast. So, yeah, they actually had some cool claims, or discoveries, I would say, not claims, but mm-hmm. you can see it in the footage. Did you write those down, or do you...
I got really excited when they found the sorry, we're still on Monster Quest here, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm still like when they found what they thought was a little dead infant, Ogopogo infant.
Yeah, it looked so convincing.
It looked really weird. It was not like anything I'd ever seen in a freshwater lake. It looked like an eel-like thing.
It really did.
Without any fins or without anything. And of course, they retrieved it and they sent it back for analysis, and it turned out to just be a decomposed salmon, which was sort of unfortunate. But it just goes to show, though, how easily things can sort of get misinterpreted in the field.
Right.
But I mean...
And they were so pumped on it, too. They grabbed it and then they went right back up to the surface. They didn't even bother continuing with it.
No, that was it. They were like,
isn't that close?
We found it. We got it. We're done.
That's it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they actually, in their dive, they did find some collapsed caves near Squally Point.
Right.
Caves that were actually mentioned in the 2000 expedition by Bill Stachewiak.
Right.
He did say that there were these underwater caverns. They didn't actually explore them, though, I don't think.
No, and that's right here, yeah, because I have, because they showed the ones in the Monster Quest doc that were
collapsed.
Visible. Well, they showed ones that were caves,
they were small.
Air quote, but they're not really
like cracks.
They were not
rock.
A like, home for a 60-foot
They're like
monster.
Cavettes.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, the collapsed caves and the possibility of them being deep enough into the side of the mountain for something to have been back there potentially, if there was anything to be discovered. I don't know.
I thought another cool part about the Monster Quest expedition was when they found the diver cave. So he descended and he was almost at the layer of sediment, and he was noticing, you see a brief snippets of footage of him in his, his underwater cam.
Yeah.
And there's, these, depressions that are very circular. They're all the same size, too. I think there were several that he saw.
Yeah.
And this was before he ended up mucking up all the sediment and getting a big cloud, and there was zero visibility and blah, blah, blah.
Which was clearly from his fins.
Right? And then, they kept trying to hype it up.
I saw something.
Something's down here, stirring this up. It's like, yeah, that something is you.
Yeah. That's sort of what happens when you're right off the bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway. But
that was interesting, though, because the thick layers of sediment, they did have these pronounced sort of depressions. And in my sort of, very crude research, I did discover some worms and sea serpents and eels that do use sediment to hide in order to catch their prey.
Right.
The bobbit worm was one of them.
Oh, that thing's freaky.
Ugh.
But it's salt.
Stuff of nightmares.
That was found in the Indian Ocean.
That's kind of the tough part about the eel theory. But anyways, we'll get into that.
Yeah, we're almost at the theory section.
We definitely, there was one other guy we need to mention from Monster Quest, though, which was Professor Sander Collison.
Oh, right. Yeah, this is important for sure.
It kind of is.
So go for it. You break that down a little bit, and then we'll tie it into some of these other accounts.
So this guy is a wind and wave dynamics professor at UBC. And he has his own theory. Just let me pull it up here. He basically has this wave dynamics theory that is... Yeah, he calls it the peculiar wave patterns theory. So he argues that internal wave structures that develop in the layers of water that are due to different pressures and... densities and temperatures can cause these rifts on the surface that appear to be a solid object but are actually the result of upward movement of water working against the grain of the surface wind. So anyways, these sorts of actions form anomalous single waves that are caused by the transfer of the energy from the lower layers of the water into the upper surface layers. So maybe there isn't actually a wind, surface wind, but I feel like that's an element too, right? Because you get the ripple and it kind of looks like something's like spilling over top.
Totally. I read a little bit further into some other like people that looked at that article and that's definitely a part of it too. Like that can obviously add to the effect of it looking like something that's...
But then...
Sure, shouldn't be there.
Yeah, but then counter theory, what if that's just a camouflage technique?
That's something that we talked about that just the other day.
Yeah,
I mean, well, first off, like, I'd like to just make reference to the Ed Fletcher photo like in terms of this theory, because I mean that makes sense to me that there could be, you know, like varying temperatures and depending on potential wind pattern on the surface, and maybe there is this sort of singular very strange wave that because of these factors, like, you know, gets churned up and it looks really strange. And we have seen things like that. Like, I have looked out into the lake from a vantage point. There's a dog park here in Kelowna that, that we've both been to before. And it's, you're a few hundred feet up above the lake and you can see, you know, you can see a lot, and sometimes you'll look and be like, that looks weird. And people will look and be like, that's the Ogopogo. And that's exactly what this guy is talking about.
I've even because seen that it's running... like when I'm at Knox Mountain, just hiking, and you see this sort of like,
Totally. Yeah. And it looks like it's kind of like you'll
it's
see
going
some
against
other,
the grain
against
of the
grain.
Other waves.
Yeah.
And the other, like the wind that you can see, and it creates different effects on the water. And then there's just this weird thing running like incongruently through it. And you're like, what is that?
Yeah. But the thing, but the problem with this theory, the just glaring problem for me, is that this doesn't account for calm water. You know, if it's, I know there's temperature differences and things like that, but if it's the middle of July and it's 35 degrees in Kelowna for like weeks at a time, and you're out there on a calm, beautiful summer day, that's when a lot of people see these strange wave patterns. I don't understand how that can necessarily get churned up in those circumstances. We'd maybe have to look into that even further, but that's where it's like we're down the rabbit hole, and that's where it's so hard when we're researching these subjects. It's like I ended up spending 3 hours trying to find prehistoric snakes yesterday. But so I think that that theory has a lot of credence to it in certain circumstances, but it doesn't
explain everything.
It doesn't explain everything. People see this stuff in calm water.
Yeah.
And that's weird. That's very, very weird to me.
So anyways, there was that guy. And then that kind of wraps up Monster Quest for me. Do you have anything else to add to that?
No, not really.
I think we should move on to theories. But before we do, I think we need to jump to our expert interview of the week.
Yeah, let's get to the interview because we wanted to get a little bit more in-depth. I mean, we wanted
to reach out to... an expert opinion.
Yeah, an expert opinion on some of the rumors about the lake. And one of those rumors is that... ideas.
Is that the Ogopogo lives in these caves, right?
Yeah, caves. So, and the possibility of even longer tunnels in the lake. So
that's, exactly.
Let's get to that interview right now.
Let's roll that track.
Hey, Dana, how's it going? Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, hi, Andrew. It's going great, and thanks for having me.
All right, so before we get going here, can you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
I am a exploration geologist. I work primarily looking for uranium at the moment, and I graduated from like a local university, actually, UBC Okanagan.
Nice. Perfect. Okay, well, you're obviously the right person to be talking to, and that's why we wanted to bring you on the program here. We are looking for some more details about the lake, just because a lot of the theories that we've been getting into, it always comes back to the possibilities of caves and the depth of the lake and the depth of sediment in the lake and the type of rock and all kinds of things like this. So we really wanted to get a geologist's perspective. So before I even jump into any of these questions, I want to get some of like your background on this. Have you ever heard about any of these underground caves in the lake?
I haven't heard about the caves. I've heard about the rumors that there might be. I never heard anything specific about them. It wasn't discussed in any of my courses or anything like that. We worked primarily above water.
Above water. Okay. Yeah. So, but you have kind of heard some rumors since then about the possibility of that. So what sort of conditions does it take for a cave to form in a lake like Lake Okanagan then?
So underwater lakes, often they formed before the water was there.
Okay.
Or started before the water was there. In Lake Okanagan, we're working with primarily like sedimentary rocks, igneous rocks, and metamorphic rocks. So for those, you need an erosional cave. You need something to have started wearing down the rock, or if it's platonic, it could be a lava tube.
Gotcha. Okay, so how does that work exactly then?
So with lava tubes, it's usually in a basaltic rock, and the Bisqually Point is actually part of the Lambley Creek basalts.
Okay, that's interesting.
The bedrock there. And what happens is, because lava is so fluid, it moves so quickly, the outside of the basalt is cooling a lot faster than the inside, so your lava is flowing through the tube, it's hardening as it goes, and then all the inside material moves out and leaves an empty tube behind.
I see.
Most of what we have here is field basalts, which is different. It doesn't have quite the same flow. It doesn't flow like a stream. It flows all in one flat section. Okay. So it's not as likely, but depending on the local geography at the time when the lava was flowing, it is possible that it could have happened.
Okay. Fascinating. Because, I mean, there's obviously, we've watched a few documentaries and things where they do take a look at some of what they call caves at Squally Point, but they're not very deep down. They're pretty much, you know, they send divers in and you can see the sunlight. It's not very deep. And we know that the lake is possibly even deeper than 800 feet in some locations. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about how the lake has been mapped or if it's been fully mapped?
There's been some seismic mapping and stuff done, which actually gives you a picture of like the lake surface and then the layers beneath that. So it'll give you sediment layers and then to bedrock.
Right.
And there has been that done in sections. There's actually a section not far past Squally Point that was done.
Okay.
And it's fairly shallow there, the lake.
Really?
I can't remember the exact depths on it, but it's definitely one of the shallower sections. The lake is fairly deep.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the deeper lakes in Canada, I guess, right?
Yes, it's quite deep.
And just the product of being a rift lake, I suppose. We found some interesting similarities between Okanagan Lake and Lake Baikal in Russia, even though it's way bigger, obviously, than Okanagan Lake. But both rift lakes, so super deep, which is really interesting to us. Do you think that there's a possibility that so that there could maybe even be some of these tunnels possibly beneath the sediment?
Oh, yeah, that's bottom? Definitely very
that's
much possible.
That's where it would be? Okay.
So because we had the volcanic periods and then we had the glaciations, we've had so much sediment put down and a lot of material taken away, which is part of why the lake is so deep and so heavily infilled.
Right. It was like 800 meters of sediment, I think, or something crazy like that.
Something ridiculous. I've got a number here. The bedrock below Okanagan Lake is about 640 meters below sea level, and the surface is like 300 meters above sea level. So you've got like 300 meters of give and take in there.
Crazy. That's a good chunk of space.
Yeah, it's massively dug out. The glaciation made the valley huge, and then a lot of material got left behind.
That's really cool. So you're saying it is possible that there could be some underwater tunnels in the lake, and that it's definitely possible that there's even maybe some bigger caves than the ones that are visible right at Squally Point directly beneath the surface?
Yep. Awesome. It's possible.
Fascinating. I guess we'll finish this off by me asking you, what is your take on the Ogopogo?
I did come across something when I was looking into the caves, and I think that it came about from reading the land, which is a Englishized term for a term I can't say because I think it's Sioux and I can't pronounce it. And it's a lot of rock formations. There's rock formations that look like a serpentine monster near Squally Point. And
fascinating. So you're taking the geologist perspective that it could be a rock, not the typical. It's a log floating in the water.
I think it came from an old legend that was based off of reading the land and the belief that a lot of ancient civilizations have that monsters and creatures at the start of the world got turned to stone.
Fascinating.
And that's what it came from.
That's your take. Awesome. Yeah. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And if you're okay with it, we'll be reaching out to you again for other geological questions.
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
Awesome. Thanks, Dana.
No worries.
All right. Well, I think our very first ever interview went pretty well.
I would say so myself.
And that was awesome. That was great to get.
Thanks, Dana.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dana.
We appreciate that.
We really appreciate it. But yeah, she...
Very eye-opening, hey?
Yeah, it is possible that these caves could be pretty big, and that there could be extended tunnels, not only at the bottom of the lake, as deep
as 1,000
feet.
I love how she plays
feet.
The rational scientist, hey?
Yeah,
sticks to her true geologist perspective.
And I agree with that in a lot of, you know, obviously.
Definitely, yeah.
Reading the land is a big part of myth creation. I can see that. Well, exactly. Creation.
And even just the idea of the Ogopogo being more of an allegory, right?
Yeah.
That type of thing. But
all right.
Does not account for everything that we have heard.
No, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the idea of there being tunnels is fascinating to me. I want to send down some submergibles and try to find these tunnels and go in them and, like, let's go, let's see how far they go.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I mean, we've heard rumors too, like ideas that there could actually be a cleft underneath the city that runs all the way out. Yeah,
underneath downtown, underneath Rutland.
Yeah, which is a long way away from the lake.
That's kind of amazing. Which would give
the Ogopogo a habitat that is much, much larger than was what is already a massive body of water, potentially.
Yeah.
But I think we're ready to get into some of our theories. Lots of
hiding spots. Right.
And, of course, one of my main theories does revolve around the caves. And
all right, let's hear it.
All right. So, I mean, for me, I think that there's... It's important to make point that in order for a species to survive, like, if this is an actual creature, if it reproduces with a partner... We looked into this with one of another In Search of, or sorry, not In Search of, another Monster Quest one for Lake Champlain and Champ, and they had a biologist on there talking about
on the other side of the continent.
Yeah, on the other side,
St. Lawrence River,
right?
That type of thing,
and a sort of similar idea: fresh water and a monster in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
But they interviewed a biologist, and basically, you know, you need a population of 50, a minimum of 50,
is what she said.
To and even with that, there's going to be extensive inbreeding, obviously, and so it won't last as long. 500 is more of a number for actually, like, sustaining a population. But that doesn't account for asexual reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
Could there possibly be some sort of a freshwater eel that existed from the megafauna era
or some sort of like reptilian snake-like thing that just evolved
to reproduce asexually. Perhaps. and maybe this thing, because think about how long things lived for back in the day. You know, like, think about how even long, like, a giant land tortoise lives today. It's, like, over 100 years, right?
How long those sturgeons live, like, you know?
Oh, yeah, over 100 years.
Easily 150.
Yeah, it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's sturgeon, and I'll mention that in a sec.
I think that's kind of ridiculous.
But the idea that something could... I think that it's definitely possible that something could have evolved to reproduce asexually, and maybe it does live in the sediment.
Mm-hmm. I think a prime example of this whole, like, oh, we thought it was extinct, but JK, it's not, is the coelacanth fish.
Oh, and absolutely.
That was found in 1938. There was two populations actually found, one off the coast of Sulawesi, Indonesia, and then one in the Comoros Islands off East Africa. So, this fish is cool. Apparently, they're very elusive deep sea creatures, which, you know, that lends to the idea that, obviously, yeah, they're not meant to be found. They don't want to be found. They're not going to be found. Anyways, it would live in depths of up to 2,300 feet below surface. They can be huge, reaching 6.5 feet or more and weigh up to 200 pounds.
Wow.
So they can live up to 60 years. So obviously that's about the half a lifespan of the sturgeon.
Yeah.
But very interesting, right? Like, we thought that was extinct for millions?
Yeah, millions of years.
Yeah.
That's wild.
It's a cool species too, because it's a transitionary species between fish and land mammals.
That
so
is
what if the Ogopogo or some sort of, you know, it was the same type of deal, and then it just evolved on its own.
Right.
And basically got cut off from the rest of the pond, and that was that, and now we might have our own little homegrown monster.
Well, I mean,
if you call it that, I don't even want to call it a monster.
It's just a cryptid creature, right? It's not a monster per se.
It's like calling Frankenstein a monster. He's not a monster.
He's just a nice guy.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other ancient fish, though, that were thought to be extinct that were found, right? Like, here's one called the hagfish, you know, existed over 300 million years ago. And this thing looks like a worm. You know, this thing looks like a giant, thick, crazy-looking eel. And this guy right there.
I see it. Oh.
Pretty gnarly-looking. But it was found And
we gotta post that.
we'll post this link. I mean, yeah, there's literally dozens and dozens and dozens of species that were thought to be extinct that have existed for tens, if not hundreds of millions of years that have been found alive.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't enough to kind without of pique your curiosity that something everything. Could still exist out there,
some people don't
want I don't to know them. What will. A lot of people argue that Kelowna, that Okanagan Lake in Kelowna is not big enough. But the sediment alone is 750 meters, just the sediment, before you even get to the water
that
at the base of the lake.
2,460 feet.
It's unbelievably massive. And I draw some parallels between Okanagan Lake for that reason and Lake Baikal in Russia,
mm-hmm.
which is also sort of like a rift lake and super, super deep and has,
did we
you
mention
know,
that Okanagan is a rift lake? I don't think
I
we did.
I don't think we actually did. We mentioned it's a glacial lake.
We said it's a glacial,
and,
but there is a rift running through the middle.
Right.
And it is responsible for the deposition of different materials, like geologic materials.
That's
so
right.
There's different types of rocks on the west side of the lake versus the east side. And the east side is primarily, it was plutonic and metamorphic. So that,
right.
like, well, Dana already, yeah, she got into
talked
that.
Talked about that a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah.
But so I mean, anyways. Ultimately, for my, I don't think I actually, like, made a point there. I'm just kind of rambling on. But ultimately, if there's something that is an actual physical creature living in the lake,
mm-hmm.
I think it's plausible that there's not a large population of them because maybe it reproduces asexually.
Mm-hmm.
And if it lives at the very bottom of the lake and is tough to find because it's so deep and maybe even burrows and lives in sediment and just kind of lives off of like microorganisms on the bottom,
yes.
that makes sense for the non-threatening encounters.
Right?
That it's not aggressive.
I actually have, yeah, some information about that type. Snake eel / water serpent.
Okay.
Oh my God, I don't even want to try to pronounce this. It's off.
Try it. Try it. I want to hear it.
Afka to die? I don't even know. But anyways, this is a family of snake eels. And most species are reportedly to be bottom dwellers. They hide in mud or sand to capture their prey of crustaceans and small fish.
Okay.
But some are, yeah, they're just herbivores, so they don't really do that. But for hiding, right? For self-defense. And that kind of, yeah, just the whole idea of the sediment, right?
Yeah.
Burrowing for camouflage. Like,
yeah.
if you don't want to be found... That's what a lot of animals do. They just dig their way
well,
into the sand.
Well, and that ties into
the
whole wave dynamic thing. We
yeah.
we talked about the
right?
idea
another
that maybe
form of camouflage.
If something, if this creature, you know, does obviously come to the surface sometimes, maybe it has, I mean, animals are really good at hiding. They're really good at that, right?
Yeah.
So if it can pick up
it's kind
on,
of important
it
to
can
them.
Pick up on a wave pattern that is not normal,
mm-hmm.
maybe it knows that it can travel on that wave pattern.
That's
right?
what
it'll
they did in Finding
it
Nemo, right?
Know
you
that
follow
it won't
the
be
current.
Seen. So
it
can exist on the surface. It can do whatever it's doing up there, but
right?
you know, remain out of sight because
it's... Do you not remember that from Finding Nemo?
I do. I, of course.
Sorry, we have to mention that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. We're talking about marine life. You have to mention Finding Nemo, sure.
Right.
Even though it's a freshwater.
You follow the current. What's that current called again? That famous one?
The one where the Australian surfer turtle takes them over.
Yeah. Righteous dude. It's amazing. Anyways.
But anyway... I, yeah, so.
So that's kind of like, okay, so we're getting into the cryptozoological argument. Right?
A little bit.
Yeah. And there's kind of two camps for this, I would say, and we're covering the first one right now, which would be the water serpent / eel / extinct species type thing.
Totally.
The other end of the spectrum for that argument is the dinosaur one, right? So the plesiosaur type species.
Right.
Out of the research I did, I feel like it's most likely that it would be an Elasmosaurus. So that has a really thick, or sorry, a really long neck, about 76 vertebrae in its neck alone, reached about 13 meters. So that's 43 feet. That's very consistent with
yep.
the reports. And yeah, I feel like out of all, because there's basically two main lineages of plesiosaurs and plesiosaurs. And they go into camps of plesiosaurs and plesiosauroids.
Okay.
And there was this guy that did an article, his last name's Williston, I don't have his first name off the top of my head, but anyways, and there's a quote from him that says, after a prolonged study of the American specimens and descriptions of the plesiosaurs, I am of the opinion that no single species of the American plesiosaurs can be placed in any known European genus. So that, to me, speaks to the idea that there's a vast disparity between these continental varieties,
right.
which maybe there's more room for regional specialization
evolution.
And evolution.
Right. Possibly. we'd have to dig deeper.
Ooh, mind blown.
Down the rabbit hole, down the rabbit hole.
Anyways.
No, that's fascinating. Because, right? I mean, I looked into some of...
And that is a peer-reviewed article. And we will have the link to that as well.
We're always trying to find the peer-reviewed articles.
Where we can. Where it's kind of hard with some of the stories or some of the subjects we're into.
And I was... Yeah, like, I looked into... Yeah, the idea that, like, yeah, reptiles. What was around here? You know, like, what was there? And
Did BC, you come up with some...
I came up with a few things, like, in terms of just North America in general. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could make the argument that some of these things that were definitely more southerly reptile species could have evolved and made their way further north. But, I mean, there was the Miocene period had a lot of alligator species in sort of... in the U.S., like in Texas, Louisiana, like, you know. Like
are we talking the days of the giant ground sloth? Because those were the days.
Those were the days.
And I wish they were here now. Kind of. Just for the sloths. Not for everything else. I don't want the giant...
You just want the sloths.
The saber-toothed tigers and the furry rhinoceroses. I don't know about that. I could take it or leave it.
Well, they're pretty cool.
They are cool, but I don't want them hunting me. I guess rhinoceros, are they vegetarian? Are they omnivore? I don't even know.
I think they might be omnivore.
The furry...
Herbivore?
Furries.
Anyway, yeah, no, there were definitely lots of alligator species. There were giant tortoises in North America. There were mastoid snakes were present in places like, you know, at the time. That was actually Australia. But yeah, alligators, tortoises, iguanas, reptiles like that through the Miocene period and sort of the more modern, crocodile. But nothing that big in our area. Like, nothing that big up in BC that I could find, but it's just a question of evolution, of a microcosm of evolution, like you talked about, whether or not something could exist. If you've survived, this is, like, something I mentioned to you yesterday, like, the idea that it's obviously crazy for us to think now, we're sitting here in 2018, to think that something from, you know, the Pliocene period survived, or whatever, or the Jurassic period, obviously, like, survived. That's even further. That's so far back, right? It's insane. But is it that crazy to think that, say, something just before the megafauna epoch survived into that epoch and then had to evolve to consume larger prey or even just, you know, whatever was
and
on the bottom of the lake.
And then just retain size and just...
Yeah, just, you know, right? And then just kind of survived through the millennia.
Did you have a specific example of that crazy... Was it? It was something from Mexico or something?
Yeah,
or
well, no,
South
there
America,
there
or?
Was a, this was just a few years ago, I think 2012 or something like that. There was the largest ever prehistoric snake discovered in a cave in Colombia. And so this snake is called Titanoboa, and it was 44 feet long. And this is an estimated length. This isn't like the potential max length, 44 feet long and weighed up to 2,500 pounds. And judging by this full scale model of it in the Natural History Museum, I think it is, looks to be at least 3 feet wide. This thing is massive. And yeah, that's in a tropical jungle, but is it possible that some other reptile or something like a reptile could have existed this far north and adapted? Possibly. I don't know.
Anything's possible.
I would like to hope so. But that was a really cool find from a few years ago. And, like, you know, it just, the sheer scale, size of these animals was just, we would be dead in, I wouldn't last 10 seconds.
No.
I'd get picked up by a dragonfly and just, like, flown away.
Like, it reminds me of the Magic School Bus when they get shrunk down. Or no, is that an episode of School Bus? Am I thinking of Honey, They Shrunk the Kids?
I don't know. So what about you though? Like what's some of your theories?
Well, for me, I'm kind of torn. I do give certain credit to Dr. Kallisall because obviously he is a credited expert in his neck of the woods. But
yeah.
At the same time, I feel like there is a little bit more than just waves. And I go back and forth between both cryptozoological arguments. The main thing for me is that I can't really find any examples of a giant eel. I can only find examples of things that are about 5 centimeters to 2.3 meters.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really make the cut unless we're talking specialization and that type of thing. Which maybe it is. I don't know. Again, though, with the plesiosaur argument, a lot of the descriptions don't really match that. And I feel like
they don't.
I feel like it moves more in a serpentine-like fashion.
The description it slithers. Like Ed Fletcher said, it basically moved like a serpent.
Right? If it's a plesiosaur, it would have one hump and a really long neck tail.
Well, here's the thing with that. Lake Champlain with Champ, that is supposed to be a plesiosaur.
Right. Like,
that's what people believe that might be.
It is more believable because it did get connected to...
the ocean.
The ocean, right? Yeah, the water level was a lot higher. Yeah. And both waterways, like there's an entrance and an exit into the ocean. And it was connected. And so maybe...
It's plausible that something could have worked its way up. And they actually
do. There is some conjecture that there is, again, these underwater channels or something. So that's another thing to
similar
consider.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the one thing about that I thought was interesting is 6 to 25 feet is the range of descriptions of Champ.
To 25?
A potential plesiosaur.
Hmm.
So that's significantly smaller than the Ogopogo descriptions, right? Up to 60 feet.
That's kind of funny they say that, because that would be a really small plesiosaur.
Yeah, that's just the average sighting. Like, that, they're not saying that's the size of a plesiosaur. I guess
it's
all
I can see. It's kind of hard to judge the...
Yeah, I know, right? But that's... But yeah, 11,000 years ago, it was connected to the Atlantic in Lake Champlain, and that's obviously a big difference between that and Lake Okanagan. It's sort of a different size and different background for sure.
Yeah.
But there's some interesting similarities. And the other thing about the search for Champ in Lake Champlain that made me think about Lake Okanagan was what one researcher did was they did echolocation. They did some sonar and they actually picked up
unknown
echolocation
communications. Mm-hmm.
And
that were similar to orcas,
referring to that correctly? Echolocation, or is it, or like,
yeah, it's like radar. Echolocation is radar,
right? So basically,
send out a signal and then it bounces off something and back to you, and that's how you know the distance from something. That's what echolocation is.
Is that what they were referring to? Yeah. Like the whale communication and stuff
It's the clicks.
Yeah. Anyway, but they picked the sound.
No, she made the example that it is basically synonymous to what humans use as radar.
Right.
Right. Right. When we send out a radar signal, we're sending out a signal that's bouncing in all directions and then it picks up and sends back what it bounces off of.
Right. And she picked, they picked up, this researcher, sonar, communication radar between multiple creatures giving off these frequencies. And it takes a complex brain to have these communication skills.
They're outsmarting us, probably.
There's nothing in Lake Champlain that
orcas
can produce that.
Are smart.
Very.
So these things, if they haven't been found.
So for me, in Lake Okanagan with the Ogopogo, I think that would be a really cool study to do if we could do some sort of. Troll the lake and
signals
and see if we can get a response or at least measure the sound. And if there is any type of strange communication or strange sound, there's been,
That would be fascinating.
Yeah. Maybe we should reach out to Bill and see if he's into that.
Yeah. Bill, if you're out there.
But I think that would be a really cool thing to kind of like further the investigation for Ogopogo, because we don't know how they communicate, and the idea that there's multiples has come up over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
If it is a they, but Daryl Ellis was the one that we made reference to, and multiples following him, and there's some other stuff to corroborate that. Like, I have a article here from 19. Where's Daryl Ellis? Basically, another Daily Colonist article where these two ladies were hanging out on the beach, and the article says an account of juvenile Ogopogo sighted by Mrs. P.V. Royal and Mrs. W.A.A. Newton.
Mm-hmm.
The women saw a group of three of young Ogopogos traveling in a pack. This is in connection to other accounts of multiple creatures traveling together in the water around the same time.
Hmm.
And that's 1927, Daily Colonist article. So that's early, but there's been accounts of multiples for a really long time.
There was definitely a few I remember from the documentaries that you watched.
Yeah.
I remember the daughter and mother. They with the big poles in the water, and they were talking about the... But anyways, I think it's time to wrap up, give some conclusions here.
Yeah, I'm ready to give some conclusions. I think I kind of already...
We already kind of did.
Opinion, but why don't you kind of wrap up your thoughts?
My thoughts? I'm kind of just on the fence still. I do feel like there is substance to the sightings and the things, especially the ones that we decided to highlight here on the show.
Yeah.
And I just, there's so much ambiguity. Like, what if there's a couple different things and people have seen different things? Because, like, it has been described, there's been so much
different lengths, different sizes,
different colors ranging from emerald green to dark black, that type of thing. And maybe that's just a result of the light. I don't know. But I'm not going swimming in Okanagan Lake anytime soon.
No.
Not just because I'm terrified of water, but just because, it's just a little too close to home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I hear
you. After you look into it a little, you're just like,
yeah, it sketches me out a little bit too. You know, I'm...
Who's got a pool around here?
This is a totally out of left field theory, and I'm not going to go in depth of it at all, but...
Let's hear it.
I feel like there's elements of this story, this Ogopogo, the encounters, that you can draw parallels to Sasquatch encounters, where the Sasquatch...
Are you going interdimensional on us?
I might be going interdimensional.
Or so, just cryptid.
I think that there's... There's connections between Sasquatch sightings and Ogopogo sightings in the sense that they're fleeting. There's never anything very conclusive. There's no body found anywhere. There's no real evidence of you know, offspring or any of these types of things. Yet these sightings just keep happening.
Or of just general, like, you'd think maybe they'd pick up a tool once in a while with Sasquatch or I don't know.
Something, right?
Very primitive, obviously.
But these sightings happen.
I don't even like to use the word primitive.
And they happen from credible, they happen with credible people throughout the years. And I think that there's a possibility that maybe this is why it became such a prominent legend for the Okanagan peoples throughout their history, that this creature is more than just a physical, actual dinosaur that survived, that it's something that appears when it wants to. Mm-hmm. And maybe Okanagan Lake is a source of some sort of interdimensionality. And I think that's one of the sort of strange theories that ties into Sasquatch too. But that's sort of my theory. I think on the one hand, it could possibly be an eel or something that has evolved and lives in the sediment. And then way at the other far end, I'm sort of thinking that because of the way it's sighted, maybe this is sort of a, maybe we're living in some sort of a hotspot where you can, where there's creatures that cross over from different sides.
We need to look into
from
more local
the other
legends.
Side of the portal, so to speak.
Exactly. Very interesting. I like that one.
You like that one?
Yeah, I like it a lot. I think we need to dive into more local legends around here, hey?
I think so, too.
We're open to anything, really. I mean, we're not going to be the UFO nuts, but we're open to that. If anyone has a cool UFO sighting, like, I'm down to hear that and share it with our other listeners. And, you know.
But ultimately, to wrap up this Ogopogo episode.
Stay on track here.
I still think the Folden film is the most compelling evidence.
It is, yeah.
It's really crazy to see such a large creature surface and submerge.
The Ed Fletcher photographs are definitely up there as well.
It looks like there's definitely a creature rising out of the water in those photographs. It does not look like just dark wave patterns to me.
No.
You guys got to look
definitely
at that.
It's a beaver or an
some
elk.
People have said beaver and elk, and you got to just laugh out loud at those.
At some of them, yeah, you can explain it away with that, but not all of them.
No. Anyway, I guess we're ready to wrap this up.
Yeah. So,
thank you.
Episode 2. Boom.
She done.
Legend of Ogopogo. Yeah, thanks for listening, and definitely reach out to us and give us your take on the Ogopogo. We want to hear it all.
Yeah.
And yeah, we have our social media available as well. Our Instagram is up and running, our Facebook. Andrew, any comments?
Yeah, just let us know what you think of this episode. And if you have your theories, please send them to us into the portal mailbox at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can connect with us on the website too, intotheportal.com.
Yep.
And
We said at the beginning, we are up on Google Play Music.
Yep.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, finally. I mean, we're still working on Spotify. We got to get some traction we got to become famous before we can get on Spotify. So we need everyone's help with that.
Exactly. Please give us your ratings, reviews, all those 5 stars really help get traction.
We really appreciate all that. And we've had a ton of support so far. It's been awesome.
Definitely. Shout out to, was it Sir John the Fourth or something? Yeah. that comment made me really happy.
Yeah.
So, thanks, John. Or was his name John or Dan?
I think it was Dan.
I think his real name was Dan, but his username was John. Anyways, thanks, bud.
Yeah. Anyway, well, thank you so much for listening to this second episode.
Look forward to the blog post coming up, as well as all of our show notes for this episode.
Yeah, we'll have all the same resources that we referenced.
Yep.
And we'll be back again in a couple weeks with episode 3, and stay tuned for that. It's going to be a strange one.
It's... All right, until next time.
Until next time on Into the Portal.
Thank you. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.